I teach philosophy at PLU, and this session is entitled, Should Healthcare Be Rationed by Age? Sorry, I should have said before that, the tape can begin. I'm always forgetting that. Okay, some of what I'm going to say here is just a bit similar to what I said yesterday in laying the background. And then I want to get into much more into the question of whether we should ration care at all. Not whether we should choose to forego care, but whether we should, whether the society or groups in the society should ration care, which is a different issue. And then most particularly, I want to get to the question of whether, if we do ration care, whether it should be rationed at all by age. And one of the reasons I want to get to that is that I not only think it's inevitably going to be part of the discussion of society, though it isn't necessarily right away at this point yet, because we're not even really very fully into the discussion of rationing yet, but secondly, because there's really a very nice book that's sparked a lot of controversy a couple of years ago, Dan Callahan's book, Setting Limits. There are copies in the bookstore. It's a very accessible book. It's not a technical academic book at all. Setting Limits by Daniel Callahan. He is director of the Hastings Center and a product of the Harvard Philosophy Department and Harvard Divinity School, and started the Hastings Center, which is one of the major think tanks, so to speak, on bioethics, out of his garage in the 60s. He's a product of the 60s, and he got this, what's now a great big institute, going by running it out of his garage for 3 years. He's an interesting character, and he defends a view that I'll talk about later, that is probably the most controversial proposal about rationing that's been put forth in any major publicized way in our society. First, just a few facts about background for those of you who weren't here yesterday, and I'll be very quick not to bore those of you who were. The reason rationing gets to be a discussion is simply escalating healthcare costs. They are indeed rapidly escalating to over 12% of GNP now, and you can see the rise is very sharp between 1950 and 1987. This figure, what General Motors spends on insurance per employee, is now up around $5,800 per year, and on per car, it's between $600 and $700 per car that GM produces. Japan's rate, if we looked at international comparisons, would be 31/3 to 40%. What the U.S. rate of healthcare spending is, and that means that there's about a $400 price break on every car that the Japanese make compared to the American competitor. This obviously has economic ramifications throughout the society. It is not just a question within healthcare. It simply points out that the resources we use on any activity are resources that could be used in other areas. It's something that people often don't recognize. There are what economists always call opportunity costs. That is, we can always spend the resource, be it time, labor, natural resources, all of which are components in what eventually comes out to be money. There are other ways we could use those resources. And behind every dollar stands something like time, money, and or time, effort, and creativity, and natural resources. Those are the things that stand behind dollars. So dollars aren't just cold statistics. They represent something very important about the human community and human activity. That doesn't mean we should make all decisions merely on economic bases. A lot of people have said, well, if we just cut out care in the last year of life or the last month of life, we wouldn't lose much and we'd gain a lot. And I pointed out yesterday there's a real problem with that. Yes, in fact, there are huge or very large percentages of healthcare that are used in the last year of life, and most surprisingly, 12% of all healthcare used in the last month of life. But note a couple of things here. First of all, persons over 65 who die within 1 year use 10% of all healthcare. That's about $70 billion now. 18%, however, of all healthcare is used in the last year of life, which means, if you compare these two figures, that 8% of healthcare is used in the last year of life by people under 65. So that is almost half of the care that's used in the last year of life is used by people under 65, not people over 65. So if we're talking about the cost of dying, here in the last month of life, we're not talking overwhelmingly about older people at all. Just keep that in mind when we get to the age rationing question. On the other hand, there are some distinct, that was my way of saying, hey, the costs in old age are not so high. But on the other hand, there are certain costs in old age that are definitely underestimated. Economists can have long arguments. I've had long arguments with economists, some of whom are on my side and some of whom are not in this kind of cost analysis. But I would argue that the cost of a $50 penicillin treatment for pneumonia in a nursing home was really $35,000 per whatever number of years we save for that person. Because it's not just the $50 for the penicillin, it's that we're running up at $24,000 for nursing home care, if assuming the person is a truly chronic nursing home patient who will never get out, say a fairly severe Alzheimer's patient, $3,000 on the average for subsequent medical care per year, and $8,000 a year in pension benefits that would have, again, these are opportunity costs because they could have gone for other things. Now, this doesn't settle the question of whether people have a right to the nursing home care, the subsequent medical care, the pension benefits, etc. It could be they do, but let's be honest with ourselves. The real cost of spending $50 on penicillin for pneumonia in a nursing home is not $50. The real cost, if the person lives another 2 years, is probably $70,000. It doesn't settle any of the moral questions, but
doesn't that $8,000 get pulled? Don't they spend that $8,000 for the $24,000 nursing home care?
Well, money spent on anything goes to other people in the economy.
But isn't that counting that
$8,000
twice?
No. I've separated this out as assuming that the nursing home care dollars are coming from another source than the person's pension benefits. They either got insurance or it's coming from their assets. They need the $8,000 to live for other expenses. Well, these are somewhat adjustable. It may not be a full 8,000, but then again, the nursing home care may be up around 30 or 40 too, in an acute nursing home. Okay, skilled nursing home. Rationing's logic, the overwhelming logic behind rationing, is simply that no society can possibly do everything in the area of healthcare. Every society has to make decisions at a certain point that there is healthcare that it will forego, even though that healthcare produces the benefit. The question, of course, is what healthcare is healthcare that should be foregone? Well, the first candidate is care that people don't want, obviously. But if people don't want it, then there's no need for rationing. So if we could get the cost of healthcare down to a level where people thought they were still getting a good bargain out of the dollars they put into healthcare by simply foregoing the care that at the immediate moment of need patients didn't want, there would be absolutely no need for rationing. Rationing is the foregoing of care, usually not by patient choice. This is where the moral rub comes. The foregoing of care that is assessed by the society to be not worth the costs. Now, to take one example that I mentioned yesterday, but here's a chart in much more detail. This is from Louise Russell's article, very good article in Science a couple years ago, about what would happen if we had a unified healthcare system and we're really making some logical and rational policy decisions about what care got first priority, what care got second priority, etc. Note a couple things about this. First of all, this is all important background before we get to the age rationing question. The chart is a table about the cost per year of life saved. It's not a chart that lists the cost per life saved. It lists the cost per year of life saved. Now right away we approach then a major decision point. Do we measure the benefit of healthcare in terms of the lives saved, or is there some other factor that's more important in looking at the human benefit of healthcare, like the length of life saved. And we could have big arguments about this. This is immediately one of the big issues that's going to come up in relation to aging. Because if you do measure healthcare, the cost of healthcare per year of life saved instead of per life saved, the cost of life saving in older years will inevitably become higher per year of life saved. The figures will look higher for treatments that are used on very elderly people than they would if those same treatments were used at the same initial expense on people who are much younger, whose lives were saved, produced much greater number of years of life. Now, but just to note that this is cost per year of life saving. It is, however, just cost per year of life saving. It doesn't involve another adjustment that is often argued for by economists in very human terms and health policy people, namely quality adjusted life years, saying that at a certain condition, a year of life is not worth what a year of life is worth in another condition. If you can't walk because you have a hip that is so damaged, perhaps, that it can't even be replaced, let's suppose, then that, what is the worth of that year of life without being able to walk for you compared to a year of life in which, for another patient or you, if you could get your hip replaced, say. These figures involve no quality adjustment to the years of life saved. But I don't just one figure here. I actually quoted it wrong. I got it wrong by a couple hundred thousand yesterday. But pap smears. This is not for women under 50. This is for women of any age, from 20 to 75. We could have a policy generally, a sort of practice guideline for healthcare providers in society, of doing a pap smear every 3 years, or let's say we could do it every year. What's the gain in terms of years of life saved, and how much does that cost us? In jumping from every 3 year pap smears to every year pap smears. It's $1,144,000, not per life saved, per year of life saved. And we're talking $20-30 million per life saved by that procedure. Which is why Russell comes to some conclusions out of this. She says any health system, if it really operated as a health system, would not advocate doing pap smears every year. Just wouldn't. Not because they don't provide any benefit. They do. Not because people don't want them. People do. But simply because it costs too much for benefit. Now, the moral question, of course, is whether or not the person who thinks they need this care can be seen to assent to that very withdrawing of care, that very rationing out of care on the basis of expense. If in fact they can't, what we've always got in rationing is a battle between the needs of society, other people, so that is just other people, and the needs of the hurting, ill person, or if not yet ill, the person who needs care, and that's why they're in a doctor's appointment. If that's the battle, my reaction to the future of healthcare in the United States is to cringe morally. If we've got simply an inevitable war between the needs of others and the needs of the patient, the solution to the moral dilemma about rationing is going to be very difficult indeed to achieve. What I will want to argue for later is that in fact the patient herself can be seen to assent to some kinds of rationing, but that'll be particularly problematic in the old age case. Okay, this is just an example of what you can see we're inevitably going to get into if we think about the cost of healthcare. It's inevitable we get into these cost-benefit comparisons. The argument is whether or not they provide an answer by themselves. Okay, now, in relation to age, let me note a couple of different proposals on the scene. The first proposal is that, in fact, we should ration care, but that we should ration it by looking at the cost per life saved, not the cost per year of life saved. As if What's really valuable to a person is just whatever life they have left. So now this view is claiming that what's of equal value is the rest of our lives. Whether the rest of our lives is a life for a 20-year-old or a life for an 80-year-old. Now, in fact, some people would argue, a lot of people would react to that by saying, oh, wait a minute, the rest of a 20-year-old's life is worth more, both to the 20-year-old and to other people, than the rest of an 80-year-old's life. Some people, however, might argue the opposite, that at least to the 20-year-old, the rest of a 20-year-old's life is worth less than the rest of an 80-year-old's life is worth to the 80-year-old. Because at 80, you realize that since death is coming fairly soon, that life is all the more precious. Number one. Number two, you have more memories. Number three, you can be more sensitive to other people. And you actually enjoy life a lot more at 80 than you did at 20. And in fact, the way you look at the rest of your life when you're 80 is, wow, if I had another 7 great years or 10 or whatever, or even just one. And so, notice how completely radically different some of the perceptions people have are about the value of life at different ages, even the value of the rest of our lives. But then note one position here, which is that the value of the rest of our lives is always equal, and therefore we should do any rationing we do in the healthcare system, any comparison, trade-off comparisons, by looking at the cost per year, per life saved. Not per year of life. Susan?
Looking at the difference between an 80-year-old and a 20-year-old, then the baby, you would spend, unlimited time on because he has this big life.
No.
That theory of
no, 20% more than a 20-year-old.
But so much more than an 80-year-old.
Oh, yes. Yes. Now, a lot of people react that way, in fact, I think, that they'll pull out all the stops to save a one-year-old, but seriously entertain not pulling out all the stops, even when the 80-year-old wants the care. These are issues that our society, we've very informally thought about these issues for a long time. People have their own personal reactions to the value of life at different ages and what the value of a whole life is, or if it's 80 whole years compared to the value of life at a particular stage. It's just awfully hard to get a systematic view about this. But one proposal is that we ration care by creating a priority list according to the cost per life saved, which its proponents argue is going to be genuinely neutral and non-discriminatory between age groups. It will not in any way disadvantage the elderly person. Okay, that's the first proposal. Second proposal is the year of life saved proposal. That we prioritize health care by cost per year of life saved. In which case, some care for elderly people will still come out a very good bargain. Notice on this one that bypass surgery this is the most productive kind of bypass surgery for left main vessel disease, costs only $5,600 per year of life saved. And if it costs that, even if we're talking about on the average 60-year-olds getting this bypass surgery, if it's a 75-year-old getting this bypass surgery, it's still going to be a pretty good deal. It's still going to be only $16,000 per year of life saved. Now, when you think about, $20,000 per year of life saved, that's still a pretty good bargain. That means that's still under $1 million a whole life. And we routinely spend money at the rate of $1 million per life saved. We don't very often go over that. If you look at people's safety decisions, how much they're willing to pay to buy seat belts, etc., as well as the amount of health insurance they bought, lots of different indicators in people's reaction. Economists will point out, and social psychologists will point out, kind of revolve around this, so $1 million to $1.5 million per life saved. But if that's the case, clearly bypass surgery for a 75-year-old is a good deal.
This is episodic, not cumulative, right? The $1 million figure is episodic, not cumulative. No one's keeping score as you're going along.
As you're going along, all the other care you're going to need in the later years. That's right. And so it may hide some other costs. Definitely.
And then the cost back there if the person doesn't make it, right?
Oh, no. The cost, if the person doesn't make it, then those costs get added to the pool of people on whom you did this surgery. And if 10 of them lived and 10 of them died, it's going to double the cost per year of life saved. Or if they live for only 1 year instead of five, it's going to cut by 80% total benefit. So one proposal is just to stick with a year of life saved. This is an economist's inclination, being quantitative sort of folk, is to use years of life saved rather than years than lives saved. And I think a lot of us would say, no, well, life saved is too neutral. There's something more important. We don't know how much, but something more important about saving a 20-year-old than an 80-year-old. But we can't put our finger on what it is, and we're suspicious about the year of life saved formula because that seems to be going too far in the direction of the young. Well, if you think that's too far, years of life saved is too far in the direction of the young, one could look at Daniel Callahan's proposal. Daniel Callahan's proposal is more restrictive of life-extending care for the elderly than the years of life saved proposal. But Callahan argues the following position, that life-extending care should not be provided by the society at all once one has reached what Callahan calls a natural lifespan. Now, he notes that this is a somewhat ambiguous concept, but then he tries to flesh it out and say why, even though it's not a precise concept, that is the relevant notion. And his proposal is that after you reach a natural lifespan, though you should be provided with every bit of long-term care, you should not be provided, or any kind of palliative and maintenance care, you should not be provided with any life-extending care. Any, no matter how cheap it is. That your claim on society just ceases at that point. Now, it sounds, no wonder his book provoked. His book is not just that proposal. His book has a lot of other interesting discussion about the notion of aging in our society. But no wonder his book provoked a lot of controversy given that position.
How does he define natural?
Okay, say a word about that. First of all, the general notion is that it is that a natural death, which is the end of a natural lifespan, is a death that is relatively acceptable in its timeliness. And he claims that every society has a notion of relative acceptability of a death in terms of the time at which the death occurs. No matter how much a person wants to live to be 90 when they're 85, people in our society, including the 85-year-old, don't look upon their death at 85 as a kind of life tragedy. Now, the pain is another matter, but if you leave the pain and suffering out of it, if you're just talking about the death, is it tragic? Is it an offense to our sensibility? How do we grieve for the person? Is it a loss for ourselves, or is it also a feeling of tragedy for that person? He would argue that the death of an 85-year-old sparks different reactions than the death of a 30-year-old. Our society, or even the death of a 65-year-old. Very definitely. And from culture to culture, you get variations here. In our society, the death at 65 is not a natural death, because we have a notion of a retirement age being part of the natural expectable course of life. So, there's no question but that Callahan would put the natural death lifespan at sometime over 75. And he's certainly not arguing that we put it down at 65. The British, by the way, say you don't get dialysis. It's not a firm rule, but generally you don't get dialysis, life-saving kidney dialysis, if you're over 65. So they have a harder rule. There is one example in their case of a harder line yet than Callahan's. He argues for this by a number of different claims. First of all, he claims just that it's a matter of equality. that the thing that should be allocated most importantly, equally to people, is life itself. And therefore, we should spend a lot of dollars, a very lot of dollars, even per year of life saved, to save a 30-year-old or even a 65-year-old before we save an 80-year-old. Because they have a right to a relatively equal lifespan. So equality is the first thing. Notice that, of course, it's equality of a whole life. It's not equality of conditions within at a particular point in life. But he kind of sits us back in our chairs at that. You know, isn't there some truth to that, to that element of equality between people?
Does he allow for individual differences? Some people at 85 still have...
No.
Are like other 75-year-olds.
No, he would argue that an 85-year-old, even one who's very active, very healthy, and very eager to live another 10 years, is they've had their share, their equal share of life. And therefore, they can live longer. We won't prevent them from living longer, but they'd have no claim on the resources of society to live longer, is what he claims. They do have a claim on the resources of society to not to suffer. That's why he never rations out long-term care or any kind of palliative care.
So there isn't any restriction on a person that pays their own way.
And there also is no restriction on a person who pays their own way, but he notes that we've already decided as a society to get out of the strict paying for your own way for a variety of other reasons.
But there would be a certain number of people who would need to do that regardless.
Yeah. Okay, second reason is for his view here is the myth, what he calls the myth of the compression of morbidity. There was a thesis back in the late 60s, early 70s, started by two authors, called the compression of morbidity. And it said, if we could just lick the diseases like coronary artery disease and certain cancers that hit people often in their 60s and early 70s, say, and if we could do a good job of wellness wellness promotion and illness prevention throughout our lives, what would happen is people would live into their 80s without any significant health problems, and they would die a relatively natural death. Natural in the different sense than Callahan's previous use. Namely, without a lot of suffering and without a lot of need for highly technological, expensive acute care. This is the image of the old natural death in the cabin that we have in America. Well, it's turned out, since people started doing follow-up studies, is this thesis really true? That every study that's really looked at this problem has shown that that this thesis is not bearing out. It's not holding up at all. People argue about how badly it's holding up, but almost everybody's agreed that it's not holding up. When we start licking certain diseases in earlier years, or when we do a very good job of wellness promotion, we still get other disabling problems later. We don't understand why, but there's no squaring of the curve here. People don't live to 85 and get hit by a bus and die, and that's the end of that. That doesn't happen. Or it does happen, but it's very, very rare. Actually, my grandfather, step-grandfather on my wife's side died that way. He got hit by a bus. And I have a colleague who got hit by a bus at 80, whose mother got hit by a bus at 87. So oddly enough, I use that figure as hardly ever happening, and I know two people to whom it happened. So that's the second reason Callahan makes this claim. A third and most important reason is that he says old age is something that needs a place in our society. It needs a purpose. It needs a mission. And he proposes that instead of seeing old age as just going out with nothing else really added, except perhaps some more problems, that we see old age as passing on the torch to the next generation. That's my way for his view. But he thinks that if, in fact, we did say no life-extending care at society's expense for people over a natural lifespan, that, in fact, what that would represent and would over a time would produce is people saying, older people saying, I have a, there's a purpose to my older age, and it's to end my life after my natural lifespan so that others can live a better life. And that would become a kind of mission for, a self-conscious mission for elderly people. Now this is very idealistic, but he's very kind of missionary and sermonic about this. He really believes that this is a kind of guiding light for elderly people. I'm sure he'll live it out in his own old age when he gets there. But that's the view. Now,
how old is this author?
55, 57, like that. I'm sure he's got all kinds of stories about people in his family who I think have actually lived this way. I mean, he's not coming out of nowhere in terms of his social and cultural and family background. At any rate, he's a vigorous proponent of those. In fact, one of the ways he wants to get them is by get the money for much better palliative and chronic care is by foregoing life extending acute care for elderly people. Okay, now how does this hold up? Well, first of all, the fundamental question is whether we should ration at all, and if we should, and whether rationing can be compatible with respect for the individual patient. I would argue that it can, if at a prior point in time, the patient, I would rather call them a patient person, because they're a patient who has a personhood over a whole life. They're not just a person at that instant in the physician's office or in the hospital. If that patient person has consented or would have consented to the sort of restriction on care, rationing out of care, that is now being imposed upon him or her. If you've got a background kind of consent to the rationing out, then you can ration out looking the patient straight in the eye, so to speak, or actually, and respecting. And there's no offense to them at all, because it represents a certain background will of theirs. But that will, of course, would have to be at a prior point in time, since at the time of need, they're probably going to want the care. I'm not talking about cases where they wouldn't want the care. Those were discussed yesterday. But, well, let's look at one example where I think this kind of thing works. And then I'll get to the age rationing case immediately after this. This is a case that was in the headlines about 5 years ago. Dr. Copeland went against FDA regulations and implanted a temporary artificial heart in his patient, Mr. Drummond, whose heart was failing, down in Phoenix, Arizona. In fact, it worked. It tided Mr. Drummond over for a successful later transplant. That temporary artificial implant keeps Mr. Drummond alive for several weeks until he gets a human heart. Since that heart, the heart that he did get, the real human heart that he did get, not the temporary artificial bridge implant, can't save someone else on the transplant waiting list. Hearts for transplant, remember, were very scarce. It was a long waiting list for them. No net life was saved by Dr. Copeland at all. He saved Mr. Drummond's life, but he lost, though he didn't know whose, he lost somebody else's life. Now, noting that, so two lives were only switched at considerable expense. Now, that's the background. Now, noting that, what would heart failure patients, even people whose hearts were failing, not knowing whether they were going to get the transplant, what policy would they agree to? Banning temporary bridge implants, which cost a lot, or allowing them? I would argue that Mr. Drummond, with his heart failing, but before he knew that he in particular would be tided over by temporary implant, would have favored a policy of denying such implants in scarce donor situations like this. Therefore, Dr. Copeland would not be violating his fidelity to Mr. Drummond if he let him die without implant. Because the policy Mr. Drummond would have chosen beforehand, if he had thought about them, of course, people, you know, we don't raise these questions for people, but if they had thought about them, a group of heart failure patients would have, if they had really looked at the situation of scarcity of heart transplants, of hearts for transplant, they would have decided to bar their heart surgeons from their physicians from using temporary implants, because they only cost no more money and don't save any net lives. So that's an example where we could actually can get patient consent to rationing out. Now, you won't often get that in other cases. That's perhaps an extreme case. I would argue, however, that you do get it, for example, with an indigent patient facing the question of whether or not to include coverage for liver very expensive liver transplants in their health insurance. There's no way, even though liver transplants save lives, they save lives at about $600,000 per life saved if you total up all the later costs of the cyclosporine, etc., and the failure, you include the failures in the net cost too. There's no way that a Medicaid patient in Oregon, for example, voting on their own healthcare package, okay, you make these dollars accessible to them. Now, do they want the package to include heart, liver transplants or not? Adult liver transplants, at least. There's no way any poor person in Oregon is going to vote for to use their resources on a package that includes liver transplants for adults. They'll include many other things, including prenatal care, but they won't include something like that if they think about it. So there is no insult to a poor person in Oregon, this logic would go, in denying them adult liver transplants. Because in fact, if they had control over the resources that are used for all this business, and even if they could tap a few more, it's not just the chintziness of the legislature, they would in fact not choose to cover adult liver transplants. If they didn't use it on other health care, they would use a lot on other health care, like prenatal care, but they would also use it on perhaps other things like schools and better houses before they would get what we might call the fat plan that would cover things like expensive liver transplants. Therefore, there are real cases of care in our society where providers should be able to look patients straight in the face and just not prescribe the care to them. Though that's very tough to do physically, it is still respectful of them as persons, given their background consent. Now, in light of that, what do we say about age? Well, I don't buy Callahan's proposal, but I do think there is a priority that we get established here. Just imagine this, you're 30. You can purchase coverage for the following for $5 a month each. Paid, look at this as over a longer life, paid for 35 years, from the age of 30 to 65. Which will you buy? And I will sort of say here, which will you buy first, second, and third? Treatment, coverage for treatment A, for disease striking age 30 to 50, coverage for treatment B, for disease striking age 50 to 70, coverage for treatment C, for disease striking age 70 and up. Each costs the same in premiums. Which are you going to include first?
A.
A. It's because it saves more life. We'd cover treatment B next, and maybe we'd get around to covering treatment C. But if we were to leave any of these out, we'd leave C out first. If you're like, therefore, I would conclude that you would buy coverage first for A, then B, and lastly C. Furthermore, this is really the key. Won't you verify that priority's wisdom even when you're 70? Will you look back on your choice to, well, I left out treatment C because I had other priorities, other things, other opportunity costs, other things I thought the money should go to. Gosh, I shouldn't have left out treatment C. I should have left out treatment A. Should have kept C in, doggone it all. No way would you say that. You'll verify the wisdom of this priority even at older age. Doesn't mean you like it. But you agree to it. You respect it, the decision you made. Now that doesn't open the door to a lot of age rationing, but it does, I think, show that there's some room for the society to maneuver insofar as people can be seen to consent to restricting resources we spend on healthcare in one area and in order to do other things in life. Now, one of the things we would certainly want to do with rationing out life-extending care, I would argue, is to make sure we cover long-term care. This also includes the prenatal care example, but ahead of time, looking at my lifetime as a whole, how do I prioritize prenatal care, long-term care for the chronically ill and disabled elderly, open heart surgery for 75-year-olds? There's just no question in my mind that though Callahan is wrong in banning the coverage, I think he's wrong in banning the coverage of life-extending care past the natural lifespan, that we would, in fact, put long-term care for the chronically ill first before life-extending care for the elderly. Because the worst thing we want is to live longer trapped in a life of inadequate resources and suffering, inadequate support. We mind less dying at 75 because we don't have open heart surgery, because it wasn't covered by the plan we bought. Now this is all sort of metaphorical because we don't just buy plans for over 65. We have Medicare, which universally covers, so we got another political animal on our hands, how to make these decisions as a whole for society. But if in fact the populace, as the populace has in Britain, for example, said that dialysis over 65, given Britain's strapped economic resources, is just too expensive, it's low priority. It would be good to do, but it's not good enough. They ration it out. Are people screaming bloody murder about that in Britain? Well, there is a kidney dialysis lobby that is hollering a lot, but does it get any support? Almost none in society. Not because people don't sympathize with kidney dialysis patients, they do, but they recognize that even if they become one and don't get the life-extending care after 65, that then, of course, they will want, it's still a wiser decision for society to leave that care out in order to do other things than to put that care in and not do something else. So there is a kind of consent here that I think we see actually operating in Britain, in the fact that there's simply very little political opposition to the British National Health Service's rationing out of care, of dialysis care over 65. I'm not prognosticating whether that's going to be followed in the United States, but I think it does show that there are a lot of possibilities open for society here. So my reaction to the age rationing issue is, Callahan's too extreme, but the issue is very definitely an issue that sort of naturally is going to come up because people care more, want to make sure that first that they're covered for non-life extending chronic care in old age and for life extending care at younger ages, and lastly for life extending care in older years. Excuse me.
You used the word wiser with respect to the decisions society made in Britain. Where's the line between wiser and more palatable?
By wise, I simply meant that people would look back on their own decisions as wise. That is, it's not really an independent substantive notion of wisdom. It's just a notion that, yes, this is what I preferred back then, and it is what I still can see is the best preference to have been carried out in the policies under which I had to live my life.
Yet there's that active kidney dialysis group not doing that.
Yes.
And aren't they the ones who we should be testing?
Well, they're very important to have around. I would not knock the kidney dialysis lobby in Britain at all, because I think it's very important that you have a kidney dialysis lobby in the society to make sure that other people who make the policy can fully envision themselves perhaps being a kidney dialysis patient someday. But that doesn't mean that the kidney dialysis lobby should control the policy. It's an odd view. I'm saying that they shouldn't be able to make policy, but they should be around.
But you're saying people will look back and say, yes, that was a good decision. Those are the people we're testing to see if they're looking back and saying, yes, this was a good decision. They're saying, no, it was not a good decision. Or are they not representative of that?
No, I think there are a lot of kidney dialysis patients who are not part of the kidney dialysis lobby.
That's my question.
Far more, yeah. Yes?
Is any author or legislator or person discussing or thinking about this consider the value of the individual life? In other words, a person who is well educated, spent his teenagers and his 20s in universities and so forth, over against the one who just went into the coal mine at 15. Yeah, I'm using extremes, of course, but any consideration of the value of the individual's life to society, because some people are most productive in their after 65. Some of our greatest poets and writers and thinkers have brought out their genius to us older than I am.
Well, there just is a clash here. Should healthcare, there just is a fundamental ideological and moral clash, and I would argue that it's not just a clash between different people, it's a dilemma within ourselves. We, on the one hand, sympathize with rationing, with allocating care, allocating, not necessarily rationing out care, allocating care primarily on the basis of what it does for the society. On the other hand, we're very fearful of that way of allocating care, because societies make horrible number one, they make horrible mistakes about what the real contributions are.
Yes.
Number two, the value of a life is not just in an individual's contribution to society, it's also an inherent value for the person, or an inherent value in the sight of God, or whatever other way you want to state the inherent value claim. And I think our society fundamentally believes, other societies may not, some other societies may not, but I think our society in particular, given its heritage of individual rights, which is a little different than individualism in a self-interested sense, fundamentally believes that there is more to the value of life than a person's contribution to society. Now that doesn't, of course, rule out what you're suggesting, that we somewhat consider a person's social contribution. But we did that, for example, in the famous Seattle God Squad, the Kidney Dialysis Allocation Committee back in the late 60s, before kidney dialysis was covered universally by Medicare. The records of that committee are absolutely fascinating to read. Some of the articles that have been written about those discussions are both sobering and scary. In the way they would try to weigh off the father of five who has a good job with Boeing compared to the homeless person down in Pioneer Square. And wait a minute, do we really want to get into that ballgame? I would argue that though maybe some of the social contribution business is relevant, it's relevant in a safe way, morally safe way, and I suppose theologically safe way too, only if virtually all people in society, even the people who aren't making those social contributions, can agree that people who make those social contributions should get those extra advantages. So you have a kind of universal consent to the rewarding of social contributions. I think you get that, for example, when even though, suppose Dan Callahan's proposal were implemented, and suppose we had a sort of culturally a general agreement that a natural lifespan, you had lived your natural lifespan if you got to 80, so people who were 82 didn't get open heart surgery, ever. even if that were the case, if we had a president who was 83, we'd operate. And that would, because there would be a, but people would say it's the principle of the thing, not the party of the person. I don't know whether that's a decent answer response to, your concern is very important. It will inevitably become part of the picture. Mark, I think you were first.
Going back to your idea about the cost, penicillin treatment, because the person keeps on living as he's ongoing living expenses. I don't understand how that's different. I mean, that seems like if that's true for anyone who's, retired. You know, if they're not, I mean, it doesn't matter if they're in a nursing home or if they're using their own resources or if they're on Social Security, that's not saying what the cost of the penicillin treatment was. It's just simply saying you're a cost to the society once you're retired.
It's a cost of the life saving. It's not a cost of the penicillin. Excuse me, I did misstate it. It's not a cost of the penicillin. It's a cost of the life saving treatment.
But that's saying that everyone who's retired
Saving the life, that's right. It's saying saving the life of a retired person is more expensive than saving the life of a 40-year-old.
Good nutrition is costly. Good nutrition is the same thing because you're saving lives.
All I made that claim for is I think we have to be honest about what the real costs are. I do not want to directly infer from that anything about, oh, well, we should let 65-year-olds die because they cost too much. Back up a minute and look at it this way. People, the only resources we have to spend on healthcare at all and on most other things in life are resources that people produce. They produce those in so-called working years. That creates the resources of the society. Any society of, to make it simple, a society of 100 people. A society of 100 people working from 25 to 65 and living to 90 is going to have fewer resources per year to spend on their lives for everything, healthcare and other things too, than a society of 100 people working from 25 to 65, all of whom die at 80. Every retirement year we have has impact on the spread of resources over our life.
See, I'm not sure it is that simple, though. I mean, a retired person often contributes much more to the society in very tangible ways than a potato chip manufacturer,
That's right. I would also, you definitely have to, that's why I wanted to be cautious about it. I don't come to any direct implications about this because I do think your points are absolutely correct that there's a productivity of people after formal retirement that is a genuine productivity for themselves and for others. And we have to include that in the calculus. But though when I retire, I would hope that I would help with my grandchildren more than I do before I retire, volunteer for more things in the community than I did before, and do all those things. I know that at a certain point, even those activities are going to drop off. And so we have to face the fact that if we're going to live to 90 instead of 80, and most of the years between 80 and 90 are not as productive as the years productive, even in those subtle and non-tangible senses, as 70 to 80, then we're going to have fewer resources per year for our lifetimes if we all live to 90 than if we all live to just 80. It's inevitable. This is just facing up to the facts.
Just one little thing about it is that I think that kind of thinking falls into the trap. I think the whole idea of gross national product is a tremendously misleading myth that I don't understand. I don't have a better myth particularly. But I think so much of what is produced and counted in the gross national product is absolutely counterproductive to the quality of life. And so much of what is not, so much production, so much activity which is not in the gross national product is absolutely important to the quality of life. And so
that's right.
Much of the statistics here can really force us into wrong conclusions.
If you use them simplistically, absolutely. And I would argue that maybe we should go to a different notion of gross national product, but it is still, there is still a more colloquial, not the economist narrow notion, but a more colloquial, informal notion of gross national product that is still relevant to these questions about what kind of life we want. Do we want a life in which we live to 90 with fewer resources per year because of that relatively unproductive 80 to 90 year period? Or do we want a life in which we don't have life extending care after 80, consequently fewer of us live to 90, but consequently we have more resources for other things in life? But ultimately, I don't see any cut and dried way to say that one choice is better than the other. My solution to this is a very kind of, don't get me wrong, I'm not a libertarian wholesale at all, but is a kind of libertarian one, that the answer to what is the right pattern here, of allocation is one that people have to make. There's no, it's not written in the nature of the universe. It's one of the freedoms that God has given us to decide how we want to arrange this life we have on earth.
Does the...
Dorothy, I'm sorry, you were...
Well, I'm having a struggle with looking at it only in terms of age and only in terms of that being one opportunity, because if we believe what we're being told, that our schools fail in the preparation of 75% of our youth, and then we're going to look at people who have college degrees and, you know, the kinds of things that the people in charge think are good, but really we know that we could teach those other people if we changed our methods and so on. At least that's certainly an argument that's going on now. Then how can we not look at what it would cost us to do that, also in relationship to this? Because if we're choosing, you know, what we choose in this area is going to affect what we can do in the other area. You mentioned it a little bit when we talked about people who want to put the money in prenatal care rather than in elderly years and so on. But I have a hard time looking at it so narrowly.
The trade-offs are very difficult to get straight in a political context here. When the Oregon legislatures are deciding whether or not, with a given number of dollars in their Medicaid pool, assuming that's already set, whether to cover prenatal care for an extra 1,500 nearly poor or poor but not currently eligible for Medicaid women in Oregon, but consequently have to leave out adult liver transplants, or whether to have the reverse policy, I don't think there's a shred of doubt in virtually all of us that they made the right decision in including the expansion of care for expansion of prenatal care. But, of course, that's a simple situation where at least the legislators thought, and this can be challenged whether they really were in this situation, but the legislators thought they were dealing with a trade-off within a finite budget. Now, if, in fact, we could ration certain dollars in care out of the healthcare system and give it to preschoolers who were in real need of extra care for... to catch them up and give them a brighter potential for an educated life later, then yes, let's do it. Now, sometimes legislative decisions really become that. If you're a congressperson, I think there's a certain legitimacy to seeing things that way. The political realities are you can't raise taxes, so we're going to have to operate within a set number of dollars, this number of dollars for this biennium or whatever, so we start doing the trade-offs. Of course, the ultimate question here is whether or not we couldn't just expand the pool. But expanding the pool would have to be by foregoing privately accessible dollars.
But I'm not talking about expanding the pool. I'm talking about looking at the resources we have and saying, if we've all agreed to palliative care and long-term care, and the children that are being born, more and more and more of them need that, and we're going to pay for it, hadn't we ought to do something at that end with the same dollars, even if we don't have
a
bigger pool?
Oh yes, absolutely. It is simply counterproductive. And prenatal care is just a stunning case. It is so senseless not to give good prenatal care to every woman, prospective mother in our society. I mean, you look at the economic studies. Every time we don't give it, you run up costs.
So it's even more important in a
absolutely. I mean, that prenatal care, you get the money for prenatal care, not by foregoing other things. You get the money for prenatal care in the long run. In this year's budget, you have to get it by taking from other things. But in the long run, you get money for prenatal care just from all the other things that not having prenatal care is going to cost you. So we ought to do it anyhow.
Especially in a society that chooses drugs and chooses.
That's right. And there are a lot of other programs for the youth that I think fall into the same category. But that's taking a blessedly long-term view of the matter, which people seldom have the will to hold themselves to. They want to know what they can do with the dollars for that they've got available for this year instead of willing to. If we were only willing to tax ourselves a little more to do some of these really productive programs, we would lower the drain on public claims later in in life, these two next.
I was going to, does the whole concept of population fit into any of these formulas and statistics and stuff?
If we were just fewer people, could we provide for more that thought?
Yeah, in other words, we're dealing with the finite resources in a total sense. And so has anybody, you know, fitted that into it?
I don't know the population controversy literature. It certainly is a mistake to think of the resources as a finite pie, and then if you have 5 billion people in the world, they're going to get so much per person out of that pie. If you have 10 billion people, you're going to get half per person, because the pie of resources expands with population, maybe not strictly linearly, but somewhat. But you get other costs of high population too, so within the United States, well, you just get a big argument between the zero population growth people and the people who say the fundamental problem isn't high population at all, it's the way we organize the society otherwise. And, that does have some ramifications for healthcare, or at least certain other population and demographic considerations do, namely the fact that we're an aging society, and we do have this really strange and difficult problem for the next 50 years. The baby boomers are going to be in their retirement by 2020, and we're going to have very few earners to support them. And since we are running, if the current budget deficit robbing of the bank, I would call it, so to speak, practices by the Bush administration hold true, we are not saving up for Phil's future in the trust fund. We're using it to defray the current deficit. We're in big trouble come 2020. But that's not fundamentally a problem of the population itself. It's a problem of the birth cohort shape of the population.